Good morning, and thanks for joining us on this beautiful Seattle morning. When I was a kid, I was in the high school band. And our band, every Memorial Day, marched in the Hood River Parade. And we weren't very good, but I do remember that one year, my father marched too. And he wore this cap, and he carried the flag. And I remember being really proud of the fact that Dad was marching in the same parade, and he had been in the military. I didn't really know what he'd done, but that seemed really significant to me. As I think back as a child, I remember that every year around Veterans Day, my father also would bring home a poppy. And at that time, I think the poppies were red plastic. And when I asked him, what is a poppy and why is it important? He said, well, it's important because this is about veterans, and I'm a veteran. Now, as a kid, I didn't really know what a veteran was. I didn't know what it meant to serve in the military, but those were questions that began festering for me. I knew I was proud, and I knew my father was very proud, but it's taken a long time for me as an adult to finally begin to understand the service that my father had, and also those of other Japanese Americans who served during World War II and in other wars. So our topic today is Nikkei veterans and the transformation of America. And we're going to focus on those who served during World War II. There were, as you may know, 22,500 Nisei who served in the armed services during the war. 18,000 in Europe, and the others in the South Pacific. Those who served in Europe in the 100th Battalion, 442nd Regimental Combat Team were in Italy and in France. And you may know that they served in 7 major campaigns, and they had the highest combat casualty rate of any group. In fact, the casualty rate was 3 times the number of soldiers who served. So they went back and back. 600 of them lost their lives. And they were the most highly decorated unit for its size and length of service after receiving 2 presidential unit citations. You may know less about the Military Intelligence Service. They served in the South Pacific as linguists and translators. They translated 2 million documents with over 20 million pages, and they interrogated 14,000 Japanese prisoners of war. And they worked the front lines with every Pacific campaign. General MacArthur's chief of staff for intelligence has said that the Military Intelligence Service, or you may know them as MIS, saved more than 1 million American lives, and they were the eyes and the ears of the Allied forces. Our Nisei sons, whom we'll be speaking about today then, served their country, but the irony is that while they were performing such heroic service, their families were also incarcerated in camps on American soil. And we're very fortunate today to have 2 speakers who will address this topic. First of all is Professor Franklin Odo. He asked me to keep his intro short, and you can read about it as well in the bios. But he was the founding director of the Smithsonian's Asian Pacific American Center, and he retired in 2010 from that position. He also was the chief of the Asian Division of the Library of Congress. His book, one of his books, No Sword to Bury, focuses on Japanese Americans in Hawaii who served during the campaign at the Varsity Victory Volunteers. And he has another book that relates to Issei folk songs in Hawaii, and I believe it just came out.
It will come out.
So Franklin's focus today will be on Hawaii as the key to upward mobility for Nisei And he'll also be sharing individual stories that share the impact of Nisei veterans on Hawaii and the United States. Please welcome me. Please join me in welcoming Franklin.
Thank you very much, Linda, and thank you all for joining us this morning. I'm not a veteran, and I don't know whether I would consider my career as having anything to do with the transformation of America. But I did want to talk a little bit about the veterans who I think really did do a lot in transforming the United States via their experiences in Hawaii. And I want to acknowledge Irene in the audience, the widow of Senator Dan Inouye, who was certainly one of the vets who helped to transform America, truly. The book that Linda mentioned on the Varsity Victory Volunteers is what I'd like to rely on for most of my remarks this morning. And I think in Asian American studies, in ethnic studies today, the experiences of the Asian Americans in Hawaii tend to get dwarfed because the numbers of Asian Americans today, close to 20 million people, is so large in terms of the groups of immigrants who have come here since 1965. That history and exploits experiences of Japanese Americans, for one, tend to get minimized. I remember when we started doing Asian American studies back in the 60s, that by the 1970 census, the Japanese Americans were the largest of the major Asian American groups. Today, we're sixth. So there are more. The largest groups are Chinese Americans and Filipino Americans, followed by Korean Americans and Indian Americans, and then Vietnamese Americans. So those five groups have many more people than Japanese Americans. So that tends to reduce the amount of attention being paid to this particular community. But I think it's too easy to forget that a lot of the work that was done in terms of getting the country to understand and appreciate the experiences of Asian Americans came through the work that was done by vets in Hawaii. And I want to just talk briefly about that, and I want to then turn it over to Tosh to tell you a little bit more about personal experiences. the book that I did about a decade ago, was about a group called the Varsity Victory Volunteers. And there were no more than 169 of these folks. And I think their experiences and their contributions to both the war effort and the way in which Japanese Americans were rehabilitated in that period was extraordinary. And some of you will remember that immediately after December 7th, 1941, Hawaii was placed under martial law. And martial law in Hawaii was the single longest period in which the Constitution was suspended in favor of the military taking over a particular portion of the country. So from December 7th, 1941, into October of 1944, Hawaii was under martial law. So in a way, although it is said that there were only about 1,000 individuals of Japanese descent who were placed in concentration camps during World War II, in a way you could say that all of Hawaii was placed in a military camp where habeas corpus and other civil rights were suspended for Japanese Americans. But so you know, I won't go through the heroics of the veterans. You know about those, the trials and tribulations. I did want to emphasize that for many of the veterans who returned, there was something called a GI Bill, which was extremely important that I think is being overlooked today with veterans returning. And that bill allowed for the transformation of the GIs who then, I think, embarked on the transformation of Hawaii and as a result of the country as a whole. So let me just tell you about a few of the people who are of the 169. I just want to mention seven or eight of these folks. Ted Tsukiyama is still an active historian with 442 and MIS work in Hawaii, and has been the principal spokesperson for both the VVV and for a lot of the veterans for many years after World War II. He grew up in a merchant family, graduated from Roosevelt High School, which was then an English standard school. And the English standard schools were an interesting phenomenon in Hawaii. They were sort of a segregated school on the basis of the ability to speak standard English. Most of us who were born and reared in Hawaii spoke Pidgin. And Pidgin English, I'm told by our linguists, is basically a second, is really a separate language and not just a corruption or bad. Anyway, that's what we like to think. That is, and so we were scolded, of course, and punished for speaking it in class in ways that I think a lot of folks who have a second language are treated in schools in order to encourage assimilation into the major mainstream society. So Ted was, in fact, they used to call him Rosie for being at Roosevelt. Those of us who were in the other public schools, I am a graduate of Kaimuki High School, for those of you who know. So we basically hated people who were from Roosevelt or Punahou, because we always thought that they looked down on us, which would have been appropriate. So Ted was an undergraduate at the University of Hawaii on December 7, 1941, and he recalls in those days ROTC was mandatory for land-grant universities. So he remembers being called up on December 7th on the radio that all ROTC members should put on their uniforms and report to the campus. So he goes up to campus and is issued an old 30-06 rifle, one clip, five shots. And they're mobilized to go into St. Louis Heights to confront some paratroopers who were rumored to have landed, Japanese paratroopers. So they're off to defend Honolulu against seasoned Japanese troops with one old rifle and five bullets. So they go. And luckily, of course, this was a rumor. And then they're mobilized in something called the Hawaii Territorial Guard. The 298th and 299th National Guard reserve units were sent off to the beaches to repel what might have become an invasion from Japan. And there was a real fear that this might have happened. So while they were off on the beaches, there was a need to protect reservoirs, hotels, hospitals, power stations that were extremely important to the well-being of the community. So they felt they were being of immense use in the Hawaii Territorial Guard. And at least half of them were of Japanese descent. So there was no suspicion that they should not be trusted with arms at that point. The need was too great. But on January 19th, 1942, about 6 weeks later, the Hawaii Territorial Guard was disbanded. So the Nikkei were not kicked out, technically. The whole Hawaii Territorial Guard was disbanded, and then it was reformed the next day, except for some strange reason there were no Japanese Americans in that group. So Ted recalls being extremely disappointed. He remembers crying about having been so distraught at this treatment. Well, he was part of a group that formed the Varsity Victory Volunteers, which on February 25th, 1942, about a month after they were basically kicked out of the Hawaii Territorial Guard, formed the Varsity Victory Volunteers, which then went to Schofield Barracks as a volunteer labor battalion. And they served for a year doing hard labor. And it's this group that I think is extremely important in turning the national leadership's beliefs about the ability of the country to trust arms to the Nikkei population that made a really big difference. And as you know, in January of 43, the 442nd was formed. But it took that entire year when Japanese Americans like Senator Inouye and all the rest of his cohort were declared 4C, enemy aliens. Japanese American citizens who were declared enemy aliens and not allowed to volunteer, except in very unusual circumstances. So Ted, I also remember, I'll tell you these stories because I think they're important. He's selected to join the MIS, the Military Intelligence Service, and he's terribly distraught about this as well, because he wants to pick up arms and go fight somebody. He wants to go into combat, and he thought this was, in spite of the fact that this is a group that was extremely important in the war effort, he was extremely disappointed. He comes back home, so he's sent to, by the way, to Burma, and so does some MIS work there, which helps to bring the war in Asia to an end. But when he gets back, he goes to Yale Law School. And those of you who know about law schools know that Yale is the preeminent law school in the country. Harvard people don't like to hear that, but but it is. And so he graduates, and he comes back, and he works and becomes the territories and then the state's preeminent labor mediator. There's another fellow whom we interviewed named Masato Doi, who became a city councilman and who was from the Big Island. And I'm not going to tell you their whole life stories, but I will tell you he had been at Mid-Pacific Institute and was befriended by a white American mentor, a teacher. And when he came back, when Masato came back from the war, he learned that his friend and former teacher had suffered a mental breakdown. And so he spent some time with his teacher and his wife and the family to help take care of this fellow. Well, the man whose name I don't recall had some ties with Columbia Law School. And so he said, Masato, why don't you go to law school at Columbia in New York City? And so Masato said, hey, that sounds really good. So he applied, and then he took off and went to New York City. So he went there, he arrives in New York City, and he goes to the admissions office and says, here I am. I'm ready for school. And the dean looks at him and says, didn't you get a rejection letter? And he said, no, you know, I'm here. You know, what am I going to do? So the dean made an exception and admitted him to the law school. those were better days, I think, when people were a little bit more flexible about how you got admitted into schools or not. Well, he graduated with honors, went back to Hawaii, and became, I should mention he was on the GI Bill, just like Ted, when he went to Columbia Law School, and became an outstanding lawyer, and then a politician, and then a judge. Yoshiaki Fujitani, who became the bishop of Honpa Honganji, Jodo Shinshu religion in Hawaii, was part of the Varsity Victory volunteers. And so he joined the group at Schofield Barracks, happily working away, building, rebuilding desks and furniture, crushing rock, painting buildings, and so on, helping the war effort. Then a couple months into his service, he got word that his father had been removed, interned. And that really ticked him off. Here I am, giving my all for the country, and they take away my dad and place him in a Department of Justice camp somewhere on the mainland. I think it was New Mexico. Anyway, he quit. He was so distraught, he quit the Triple V and left for the duration. But then when the enlistments opened up in January of 1943, he saw all his friends disappear into the Army. And he, the way he puts it is, he got lonely. All his friends are gone. So he decided to enlist, and he went into the MIS also. Now, he has also an interesting story during the war. So he's training in Maryland at Camp Ritchie. And one of the things he's not a part of this, but he witnesses is a bunch of his Japanese-American colleagues being outfitted with Japanese uniforms and being paraded in front of the other American troops to show the troops what Japs look like. And he said that was really extraordinary. Disappointing kind of information, experience. But he comes back after the war, and he says he wanted to make the best possible use of the GI Bill. So he chose the most expensive school he could think of, which was the University of Chicago. So he goes to the University of Chicago on the GI Bill and studies religion. Now, his father had been the bishop of, he grew up as the son of the bishop of Hompahunganji, but had some questions about whether this would be appropriate for him to pursue or not. At the University of Chicago, he finds that Buddhism as a religion is being taught at this top school, and it reconfirms his interest in the religion, and he goes to Japan to become ordained. So that's Bishop Fujitani, who's still around, by the way. I want to tell you about Anki Hoshijo. Anki Hoshijo was one of the 169 folks who were not part of the University of Hawaii guys, because the folks who had created this unit were disappointed that so few people had volunteered. So they went out into the streets and got some gamblers and boxers and all. And in the pre-war days, the Nikkei community was not like today. This was a really working class, streetwise group who were really, really tough. And so there were whole bunches of Japanese Americans who were outstanding boxers. And you don't see that today. But boxing is a sport, if you can call it that, that requires you to be able to take some really, really hard hits and give some in return. So you've got to be pretty tough to even entertain the notion that you can do that. Anki was a flyweight and very good. And so he beat up a lot of people. He lost one fight in the 40s. And that was to a fellow by the name of Dado Marino, a Filipino boxer. And some of you are old enough may remember Dado Marino became the world's champion flyweight. So Anki lost only to the best. But then he gave it up, thank goodness, I guess. But after the war, he went to Northwestern, another outstanding school on the GI Bill. And he recalls, I remember him telling his sons, he would never allow himself to be interviewed because he said, there are too many people making claims about being veterans and talking too much about the valor of the folks. So this may be heretical, but he said, I don't want to be part of this because I think we're making too much of the veterans. And And so he refused to be interviewed. But at Northwestern, he studied business. And he said, all my friends who came out of the 442 were fooling around. I mean, they were just going bowling and shooting pool, drinking beer. And so he wanted to study. And so the only way, he said, he knew how to get by these guys without being pulled aside to go into a bar was to put his books in a bowling bag and pretend that he was going bowling. So, oh, no, I got to go roll a few lanes or whatever you do. So that's Anki Hoshijo. And then I want to mention one last instance of Edward Nakamura, who became one of the justices of the Hawaii State Supreme Court. And interestingly, he was joined by another Triple V veteran named Yoshimi Hayashi. And in the 50s and 60s, Hawaii, I'm not sure if this is still the case, Hawaii had five, I think they have more now, had five Supreme Court justices. And at one point in time, two of them, 40% of the state Supreme Court was made up of people who had come from this small group of Varsity Victory volunteers. So it was really an extraordinary kind of experience. So this is a group that when they come back, and I've just given you half a dozen examples, when they come back, go to top-level schools or the University of Hawaii, graduate, and really become dominant in Hawaii politics. And I think this is where you get the George Ariyoshis and the Sparky Matsunagas and the Masato Dois and the Danny Nois, who then take the community to an entirely different level by virtue of the way in which Congress works, that they are so extraordinary and have such a loyal constituency back in the islands that their longevity allows for unusual and disproportionate influence in national politics, not just local politics. And I think it, arguably, this is the sort of thing that helps transform some things, including redress and reparations that Sparky and Dan were all involved in. So this is sort of some of the background that allows us to understand how that came about. So that's what I wanted to tell you today. Thank you.
Thanks, Franklin, for helping us to expand our understanding of those who gave service to our country. I might mention, too, that Hawaii is the root of the 100th Battalion that became part of the 442nd Regimental Combat Team. So Hawaii has given a lot in terms of our service. And that's my transition to Tosh Okamoto, who is a veteran of the 100th Battalion, 442nd Regimental Combat Team. He's given a lot in terms of the transition and the transformation of America through his post-military service. He was a founding board member of the Seattle Cato Nursing Home and Nikkei Concerns. He served two terms as president of the Portland Nikkei Concerns, and he's also served as commander of the Seattle Nisei Veterans Committee. He continues to give service to his community, and he will be talking with us about his own experiences in the military and his service afterward. Thank you very much. Tosh Okamoto.
Thank you, Linda, for that introduction. When Franklin talked about the Hawaii GIs, when I first was assigned to the 442 in Italy, this sergeant, he was a Hawaiian, I guess he was a Hawaiian sergeant, he said, Okamoto, you stay go guard. What the heck are you talking about? That was a typical language, and I think eventually we learned to love that pidgin language that we're talking about. But I'm really honored to to be a presenter alongside with the distinguished Dr. Franklin Odo, along with, of course, our moderator, Linda. Please bear with me, as I'm just a blue-collar guy, especially after hearing the powerful speakers yesterday and what you'll probably be hearing today. Tom Comentani, the third scheduled presenter, is recovering from a slight stroke and doing very, very well. My contributions as a World War II veteran and a member of the honored 104th 42nd is very minimal. What the men did to make our lives better inspired me to continue to try to make life better for my community for the rest of my days. Presenting you with my rather boring and common bio may give you some ideas where and why I did what I did. I was born in 1926 to Juhei and Sugi Okamoto here in Seattle, Washington, approximately 3 blocks from where we currently reside, which made a full circle in 86 years. I had 2 sisters and 1 brother, along with 2 Kibei half-brothers and 2 Kibei half-sisters from father's first marriage, who were educated in Japan before returning to America. The difference with the Kibei brother resulted in a family discord later over the loyalty oath. The Great Depression left father jobless, like many others, especially people of color. The only possible employment for dad was farm labor. I was very conscious of the WPA, a government-subsidized employment for the jobless, but I never saw a person of color in that program, which was my first exposure to racial discrimination. I grew up in various farms in the greater Seattle area, and I attended a little school called Panther Lake Elementary School and Kent Junior High School prior to being in prison. Dad was finally able to have his own farm. Economically, things were improving. Most of our produce was sold here at the Pike Place Farmers Market, now called the Pike Place Market. Dad could not drive, therefore I drove him to the market early in the morning, then picked him up after school. He took great pride in his leeks, you know, the onion, big onion, the leeks. He was very good at raising leeks, which sold very well, of course, until December 7th when no one would buy produce from a Japanese farmer. On December 7th, I was spreading chicken manure out in the field. My sister Aki came running out and told me Japan bombed Pearl Harbor. Like many, we didn't know where the heck Pearl Harbor was. I was confused, but had this very ominous feeling it was not going to be good for us Japanese Americans. Shortly, as you know, we were placed under curfews and limited travel. I don't recall any acts of racial discrimination from our Caucasian neighbors or at Kent High School, possibly because of the many Japanese American students at Kent High School. In the city of Renton, racist signs went up in stores. Father said when he first came to Renton with others many years ago, rocks were thrown at them. Dad decided not to prepare for the following year's crops due to uncertainty, plus we did not own the land. We had no income by then, and so Dad sent me to a Japanese-owned farm at Marysville, Washington, along the Columbia River, where the river influenced mild temperature resulted in early crops. By then, the city folks were being incarcerated. Therefore, we had to apply to travel home through the local racist sheriff. He really gave us a hard time. But he finally issued our travel permits with great reluctance, but he had no choice because of President Roosevelt's Executive Order 9066. The area was across the river from Hood River, where later Nisei servicemen's names were removed from their honor roll. We were ordered to the Renton, Washington train station. The curfew and travel restrictions, along with probably the most racially despised group of Americans at that time, compounded my fears upon arriving at the Renton station, where we were met by soldiers with bayonets and guns. My family initially were imprisoned at the Pinedale Assembly Center, then transferred to Tule Lake concentration camp, Northern California, where I finished high school. My family wanted to go to Minute Oak, Idaho concentration camp when Tule Lake became a separation center. Due to father's illness, we were delayed and Minnesota was full. Therefore, my family completed incarceration at Heart Mountain, Wyoming concentration camp. This period was a traumatic time for my family. My oldest Kibe half-brother, Shigeru, and I had heated arguments, which almost became physical, about the signing of the loyalty oath. He felt since he was the oldest, and in Dad's illness, he could just dictate to us, ordering us not to sign the loyalty oath. This incident became bitter feeling, caused bitter feelings towards my brother, which did not heal for many, many years. He, along with my other brother, Takumi, was imprisoned during a riot at Tule Lake. I did not realize how intense the riots were at that time until we transferred to Heart Mountain, Wyoming. There was demonstration as well, which was not as intense compared to Tule Lake. It was no interest to me, as I was already made up my mind and signed the loyalty oath. Through curiosity, a guy named Okamoto, my namesake, was well known for his speeches against signing the loyalty oath. Not sure whatever happened to him. Maybe some of you may know. My sister-in-law asked me, since I was in the Army, to write a letter to the Attorney General requesting my brother Takumi, half-brother Takumi's release to his wife at Tule Lake. I doubt if my letter did any good, but eventually he was released. When President Roosevelt formed the 442nd, I wanted to volunteer, but my mother did not want me to go due to father's crippling heart attack. From Heart Mountain, I went to work in a mom-and-pop type of a sawmill at National Forest near Cody, Wyoming, which was a real unusual experience for a young guy like me. We logged in knee-deep to waist-deep snow. Per Forest Service regulation, tractors were not allowed in the forest at that time. Logs were towed by a horse to a landing site where they were loaded on a sled and towed to the sawmill by horses. I was the only Nisei among the five co-workers who were Issei. I was taught at home, like my fellow Nisei, to respect your elderly, which held Issei in high esteem. To my surprise, they talked a lot about sex in Japanese. I suppose common to a group of guys anywhere. I soon learned they're humans just like the rest of us. I was appointed to be the spokesman since I could speak English. The owner's wife cooked for the crew. We ate a lot of venison. Whenever she got low on meat, they just went out and shot another deer. The following year, matsutake was very plentiful. Issei asked me to tell the cook to broil some, but she was very, very reluctant, as she said she did not want to poison the whole crew. Issei broiled it themselves on the cabin wood-burning heater, but it would have been much better if we had some shoyu and vinegar or lemon juice. I was drafted to the Army in June 1945. The war in Europe was over, but I went through basic training at Camp Lee, Virginia, then on to wheel chassis mechanic training in Aberdeen Proving Grounds, Maryland. During a routine Saturday morning inspection, the inspecting officer seemed to be extra critical of my rifle, shoe shine, haircut, etc. I thought, boy, I'm in trouble. But he called me in front and center and told the platoon, here's a model soldier. He must have some fondness for the Nisei due to the 142nd, because I certainly did not make any extra effort to be a good soldier. I was assigned as a replacement to Company K of the 442nd Regimental Combat Team in Leghorn, Italy, as a rifleman. On March 1st, 1946, the 442nd colors returned to the U.S. and honored by President Truman. I did a lot of close order marching drills in Italy in preparation for President Truman, but I did not have enough points to go home with the regiment, and was assigned to the 88th Division in Northern Italy as an auto mechanic, and remained there until discharged at Fort Dix, New Jersey on February 47. part of the discharge interview, I was asked if I would stay in the Army with the possibility of the officer's candidate school. I was amused. I was just a lowly PFC and was war over. There must have been an abundance of officers. Of course, I did refuse as I had enough for the Army. But I found out later that some Nisei were also recruited to the OCS. And the reason, I presume, was the high respect of the 100th and 442nd. I feel privileged to have been assigned to the 442nd. In the short time as a member, along with attending many reunions, heard many experiences that their families have probably never heard. Seemed like when they were with comrades, they freely talked among themselves. I fell in love and married my dear wife, Toshiko Akagi, November 6, 1949. That was 64 years ago. We are blessed with 4 children, 9 grandchildren, 4 great-grandchildren, and another one in the oven. On return to Seattle, I attended the Broadway Edison Auto Mechanic School from 1947 to 48. Upon graduation, the Seattle Area Auto Mechanics Union would not accept Japanese Americans. They were the recognized apprenticeship program monitors. My Caucasian classmates' apprentices were hired immediately. I finally found employment in a Japanese-owned auto repair shop for my apprenticeship period, and then was employed by the U.S. Navy as a civilian auto mechanic. I finally found long-term employment with the Seattle Fire Department. I was the first minority hired by the department for a progress from a mechanic to supervisor in that period of between 1953 and 85. Many firemen were World War II veterans of the Pacific Theater. Some were very cool towards me. But as time went on, they found I was a veteran also, and today I have many retired firemen that are dear, dear friends. In addition to this employment, we successfully invested in some real estate and apartment house owner and developer since 1951. I, along with our community, honored and revered the 442nd, and being a late replacement did not contribute towards this honors, made me feel strongly I must continue the goals and sacrifices of the 442nd to make life better for the community in my own modest way. Being a member of the Nisei Veterans Committee opened the doors to my modest goals to contribute to my community in many ways, recognizing the hardships and sacrifices of Issei did for Kodomo no Tame, for the good of our children, especially the Gold Star parents, whose life would have been much, much better and richer by a surviving son. I was instrumental in establishing the senior services program for the Issei at the Nisei Veterans Memorial Hall. I chaired the annual NBC New Year's Issei lunch honoring the Gold Star parents. My wife, Toshi, and other auxiliary members in delivering Memorial Day flowers to the Gold Star parents, transporting them to the Nisei Veterans Memorial Day service, installation banquets, picnics, cookouts, along with other significant NBC activities. My post-war activities to the present in the Seattle Japanese American community has been very busy and quite satisfying. My crowning achievement was participating as one of 7 founding board members, then named Issei Concerns, now called Nikkei Concerns, founding of the Seattle Keiwa Nursing Home, and the Nikkei Manor Assisted Living Facility, the Kokorokai Daycare, and Nikkei Horizon Education Wellness Program. I served 2 terms, totaling 4 years as the president of Nikkei Concerns, and continue to serve as a Nisei Concerns Advisory Committee to this day. I was a commander in 1970 to 71 as the Nisei Veterans Committee and continue to serve on the Executive Court Committee. What triggered me in founding a community nursing home is as an NBC commander, with my vice commander, we visited a Gold Star father in a nursing home. Another son was also visiting his dad, and he asked us if we had some change. He told me when his dad pushed the call button, staff would see if he was holding a coin. If not, they would just ignore him. Needless to say, that really angered me and really pissed me off. What a disrespectful way of treating a Gold Star father. In talking to others, this is not unusual for other East in the nursing homes due to the inability to speak English compounded by illness. I was fortunate that our oldest daughter, Joyce, was working at the Los Angeles Kiro Services, who introduced me to the CEO, Edmund Hiroto. Ed was very helpful and was instrumental in helping us founding of the Seattle Kiro. I'm very proud and grateful to our community that supported in establishing a much-needed community-owned nursing home almost 40 years ago to live loving care to my mother, my mother-in-law, as well as many other ISAE. The younger generation has taken over, and I'm extremely proud of their leadership in taking it to another level. I also serve as a director for the nonprofit Kowal Memorial House, 160-bed unit elderly housing since 1987, and two-term president. Also chairman of the Boy Scout Troop 53 of the Japanese Baptist Church. I was a founding member, one of the founding members of the Gopherbrook Veterans Association, later named the Japanese American Memorial Foundation, suggested by Mike Masaoka at the Nisei Veterans Reunion in 1988 in Reno, Nevada, to establish a memorial in Washington, D.C. to the Nisei veterans, which ultimately became the Japanese American Memorial to Patriotism for All Japanese Americans. I was a co-chair with the late Bob Sato for fundraising here in the Pacific Northwest. Our goal was 700,000 and was surpassed by 1.4 million, along with establishing Nikkei Concerns, sponsor of the Kiro Nursing Home, Nikkei Men, along with the community churches, the Cultural Center, the high regard for the Nisei Veterans Committee, the NVC Foundation makes me proud of my community. I recently attended the Minidoka pilgrimage, was asked to read names of the Minidoka soldiers that killed in action, which brought out emotions and anger. Some of these names, men's funeral service, were held right here where the loved ones were still in prison. Reflecting on my fulfilling life and what these men missed continues to encourage me to remember and honor them. I have been blessed with a loving, supporting wife and family in my endeavors, and we can be proud of our heritage of Gambare, Shitakaraganai, Gama, Enyo, etc. Gave us strength for most of us not to be bitter towards our country that we have every reason to be. And God bless America and the nation that applies and corrects. Thank you.
Tosh, thank you so much for taking time to compile your thoughts and to write them and share them with us. I think especially for those of us who didn't experience the war and really have no idea what happened in the military and then to see the service afterward, your ability to share with us your perspective helps us to get a glimpse into what that was like. I still can't imagine, but that was very useful. So thank you so much for doing that. We are at a point now where we would like to invite you to ask questions. One thing I noticed, too, is that we have a number of youth here, and you're the group that are going to carry on the stories. So we hope that all of you will contemplate questions that you have, and there is a microphone right there. So please join us in taking advantage of the wonderful resources we have here. When you ask your question, please identify yourself and speak into the microphone so we can all hear your question.
Okay, my name is Richard Murakami. I'm a volunteer at the Japanese American National Museum. And whenever I get a chance, I don't have a question, but I like to speak at these things because I want to kind of show my respect and admiration for the men of the 100th and 442nd. And when I first learned about them was, I was a member of Optimus Club. I met another member of Optimus Club. We were having dinner, and then he was telling me that when you graduated from school before 1941 and went to get a job, you couldn't get a job as an engineer. So what did he end up? Working in the produce market, like many men and women that graduated before 1941. That's what they did. So he told me about it, and he said, World War II, he was in the 442nd, and he said, I won't tell you the kind of things he did to try to get in because he was shorter than I am, you know. So, but then he says when he came back to Los Angeles, he was able to get a job as an engineer with the aircraft company. And that's the first time I learned about how they weren't able to work or pursue a career until after because of what they did in the 442nd, you know, they was able to get a job. And that's when I first learned. So when I went to get a job, the person that hired me was a captain in the U.S. Navy, but he knew about the 442. I think that's one of the reasons I got a job. And my whole career, I say, is because of what they did, what the men did. Men, 18, 19-year-old men, what they did in World War II really helped me. And the museum had a remembrance project. I wrote a short note. And because I want the Sanseis and Yonseis to know that they are able to do what they do now and get what they do now because of the men in the 442 and MIS. And it's not me, it's them. And I want to say thank you to them.
Thank you very much. Did you have a comment, Tosh? Did you want to respond?
Reflecting back, I feel very strongly, as many of you do, that the Nisei contribution was really great. But we have to reflect back on Issei and what they went through, and what the 442 did, and what we all do, and we all have some of that culture of the Japanese culture that brought us through all this. The word that you always hear, the shikataganai, gaman, and all those things, I feel very strongly that that's what really held us together because we had every reason to be really pissed off about what the government did to the point where we couldn't do anything, but that didn't happen. We still survived, and we did very well for what we went through.
I will say, too, that from my interviews with Nisei veterans, they, as you did, don't accept the recognition for themselves. They recognize, in fact, the contributions of their parents and the great foundation that they received from them. Let me just stop and ask, are there other veterans of World War II here?
The reason I want to make a comment is when I came in here, I thought that there would be a lot of veterans like myself, 442nd or MIS. But when I came in, I was very surprised at the great number of women and younger people here. So let me tell you a little bit about the 442nd. Just like the evacuation, we were Japanese Americans and we were told to go to internment camp. And I went to Manzanar. My family was one of the first ones. I was the last one into Manzanar because I was going to stay out and fight the United States government for making such a law. And as you know, Korematsu and Hirabayashi, they did, and Yasui. And if you look over the program, you'll see that both my daughters, Kathy and Lori, who were the attorneys representing Korematsu and Hirabayashi, were still very active. But let me tell you a little bit about the other thing that the government did, not the government but the military, they said all Japanese Americans will now be exempt from the United States Army. I was 1A when the war started, and I signed up to serve in the military. When I went to Selective Service, they told me that you're Japanese American, you're 4C,
that's right.
An alien and eligible for service. I couldn't believe that. I'm third generation Japanese American. So what I did is I went to Manzanar, and then I volunteered to work in Idaho, in Rexburg, Idaho, in the potato fields. And from there I went to Washington, D.C., and I had a friend, Mike Masaoka, who was a lobbyist there, and we decided that we would try to change our status, 4C to 1A, because there were so many of us that were willing to help and to work in the United States military, and they wouldn't take us. Well, after a long while, most of the work at the Pentagon, they said, you know, one thing we have a lot of Japanese Americans already in the military, and we have a problem because they're going to be shipped to the Pacific area, and we don't want them over there because there'll be a big problem fighting the Japanese, looking Japanese. So we're going to take them out and form a unit anyway. And he says that would be one thing. So after a while, we got the permission to go to Camp Shelby, Mississippi. And they said, we are going to start a Japanese-American unit. And while there, the first ones that came were from Hawaii. And in that group was Dan Inoue and Spark Matsunaga, two friends that later on became real important to me. The Hawaii boys came, and then the military sent the people that were in the Army already to Camp Shelby. After that, I asked if there was any way that we could get to the camps, because they also didn't know that they would be able now to be 1A in the United States military. So they said yes. So we got small town groups, and I went to the 10 camps and told people, if you are eligible for the draft, volunteer, and you can become part of the United States military. And as a result, the 442nd began to grow. I was in the original headquarters company, but I formed the 522nd Field Artillery, 232nd Engineers. I was into the 522nd originally, and as a result of it, of shooting 105 howitzers, my hearing is very bad, because all during the war I was shooting big 90mm 105. But anyway, I just wanted to let you know that if it wasn't for the Army saying that we are Americans, even though we're of Japanese ancestry, we would have never been able to serve and to prove to the people of the United States that even though we're of Japanese ancestry, we are Americans at heart and 100% Americans. Thank you.
Thank you. And this is Paul Benai, and he's a retired legislator in California. Might mention, too, that it was, I believe, February 1, 1943, when President Roosevelt designated that there would be Japanese Americans serving in the military. At that time, he said, color should not be an issue. which was very ironic because, in fact, while the members of the Japanese American community were then serving in the 100th Battalion, 442nd, and in the MIS, their families were incarcerated. So that was very much a contradiction. Are there other veterans here? Not only from World War II, but other veterans as well?
Yeah, I'm sure there is. Yeah.
Okay. Thank you. Oh, Homer, hi. Thank you. Could you give them, and I want to be sure that you have a chance to ask other questions because we have about 10 more minutes. Other questions that you have for our veterans or about veterans? Thank you. Well, I have a question, and hopefully that will prompt others from you. I was interested to hear from Tosh about the heated arguments that took place about the loyalty questionnaire and about the turmoil that you felt in responding with respect to your elders. And so you focused on the right way to do things. Well, as we continue with our legacy, certainly, as we've said, we've learned a lot from the Nisei veterans, as Paul Benai has mentioned. But in fact, we continue to have challenges of race, challenges of sexuality. There are many more issues beyond what we are facing right now. And so I'm wondering from our panelists, but I'm also wondering from the rest of you, what do we do now? The topic of our conference is let's look at the past, but let's also look at the future. What can we do to speak out? Actually, one other example is I appreciated that Tosh was talking about, and it still gets me, to hear the Issei man at the retirement center who was not respected, who in fact had to pay to get attention. And that particular act prompted you to begin looking at services for other Issei. That's the kind of activism that I think is important. It doesn't necessarily take words, but it takes looking at something that becomes a pivotal moment. What can I do to make a difference? So my question is, from the past, what can we do to look at issues that continue to fester, that are not solved? And I'd like to begin with our panelists and then go to you and ask for your ideas.
Well, I thought Alan Nishio did a pretty good job this morning of trying to inspire us to take account of, you know, the different kinds of challenges that we still faced. In my own way, this is something that I've tried to do in public service, teaching at the universities, getting Asian American studies and ethnic studies off the ground was a real struggle, and it's still a struggle on many campuses where even in the high schools in Arizona where ethnic studies is being threatened by the state administration. But, you know, after 3 decades at teaching at the university level, I had an opportunity to go to the Smithsonian where, and, you know, museums are places where I should back up and say not very many of us actually learn a lot of history from textbooks or whether high school or universities. Most history courses are fairly boring. I say that as an historian. And so scholarly monographs, even like the ones I've written, don't reach very many people. I mean, it's not the kind of language that people use. Most of us learn our histories from documentaries, now websites, museums, historic sites, Wing Luke Museum, you know. Those are places that people, average people, go to, and the vast majority of us get our histories there. And so when a place like the Smithsonian puts on an exhibit and says, this is what happened, for example, the More Perfect Union exhibition that was on and came down only in 2000 about Japanese Americans in World War II, then people sort of assume if a mainstream organization like that
as part of the federal government, says this was true, then it must have been true. So it validates things. So trying to get places like the Smithsonian and the Library of Congress and the National Archives to pay attention to areas like this, I think is, you know, one thing with my particular background that I can do is something that I want to try to do. I'll just say, recently I've gotten involved with the National Park Service, which is a huge enterprise. I mean, it's got tens of thousands of employees, and many of us know about Yellowstone or Yosemite or Grand Canyon, but it has thousands of other historic sites, including in urban areas. So the National Register of Historic Sites has 82,000 sites that you may have gone to but don't necessarily associate with the National Park Service. It also has 2,500 National Historic Landmarks, which are slightly like Mount Vernon in Virginia. So those are places that are really important because people go there as sort of pilgrimages and see these and say, okay, this is what really happened, and this is important enough for the nation to recognize. Well, out of those 82,000 and 2,500 sites, the places that commemorate experiences of people of color, all people of color, amount to no more than 3 or 4%. I mean, we're very underrepresented. So this is like we don't exist there. And so this is the kind of thing that, you know, some of us are trying to do. But this kind of activism can go on up and down the line all over the place.
Surprising to me, you know, I'm pretty well along in years. And my typical history class that we took, we went on a Mississippi a riverboat cruise, and somebody was talking about all these Indians in the Southeast, Native Americans, were all moved to Oklahoma. That's all that can be. I never heard of such a thing. But that's a fact, you know, and it wasn't like us, you know, we had transportation. They had to find their own way, and it was a horrible, horrible. So I guess, you know, it just points out that, you know, we need to do a much, much better job of history of telling what happened. So that was my comment.
Actually, interjecting a personal story, I remember as a kid really disliking history because for me it meant memorizing names and dates and places and taking multiple choice tests. And the answers weren't just A, B, C, or D. It was A, C, and D, or F, G, and H. And so I really didn't like history. And it wasn't until I began asking questions of my Issei grandmother and Nisei veterans where I began to realize this is history. I'm learning about history. I'm doing history. And so, in fact, being able to gain those first-person stories and understand from others does help to move us toward that activism, that small activism we can take. Are there other ideas or other questions? Thank you.
I want to thank Franklin Otto and Tosh and all of you for bringing this kind of issue to light. I'm a teacher, retired teacher, Mariel Tsukamoto from Florin, California, and my mother was also a teacher who was an activist and early on started an education program. And as a teacher, I want to say that, you know, you wait until college and it's really too late to influence the kind of character and the commitment that has to come from within your soul. Mm-hmm. You have to start at a younger age. And I do know that there are three factors that will affect institutionalizing a concept. It has to be taught in the colleges. It has to be accepted as sort of known knowledge. So you have to educate the public. And the third, it has to be published. And I think in these days, it has to be online. So I'm urging all the families, you need to start participating in colleges and universities that have programs where you can leave papers, where you can leave oral histories, and leave enough work so that people can have access to it in the future. Because if we forget the past, we won't know how to protect the future. And my mother started in 1983 a program in her own little school district, which was Elk Grove, that was very unfriendly towards the Japanese during, pre-World War. It was one of the hot spots in that Sacramento area. And she attended a segregated school. But as a teacher, that school board in Elk Grove, against probably the wishes of many of the members of the community, named a school in her honor. And I think that was a way of the community, the school board saying to the community, we're not going to have those kind of prejudicial feelings anymore. And I do know that every year between in January, February, and March, we run a program about talking about the internment. We do include a lot of information about the veterans because that is a key portion of why we got accepted. And I think we had 5,000 students go through it this year, the fifth graders, and over the years we've probably touched 40,000. Now some of those have become teachers, and every time you educate a teacher, you educate a whole group of people. So I'm urging people to participate in these programs and leave your story because it's important.
Thank you very much. As a teacher, I also heavily endorse what you are doing. Unfortunately, we don't have time for any more questions. I'm sorry, because our time is up. But actually, to take your theme of teaching, I discovered a book that relates to, it's a children's book related to kids called Speak Up. And it relates to bullying and other issues. But I think those, I totally agree with what you're saying in terms of looking at our youth. That's why I'm pleased to see so many youth here. And using that as another venue for sharing our stories. Thank you so much to our panelists for their words. And thank you to you for joining us. Enjoy the rest of the day.
Thank you.